The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles, at least initially, from the Harvard Health Letter. And the first article is called Protect Yourself from Falls Outside the Home. Here's how to identify and avoid fall hazards in everyday destinations. And this comes from the May 2024 issue of the Harvard Health Letter. Even if you've fall-proofed your home, the outside world is full of hazards that might lead to dangerous trips and tumbles. And since falls are a major cause of broken bones, head injuries, and injury-related deaths, especially as we get older, it's essential to know how to stay safe once you step outside your door. Here are tips to avoid falls in a variety of public areas. The first is stores. Stores often have smooth floors that can be slippery or even wet. When you're going shopping, make sure you're wearing shoes with non-slip treads. If you suspect that you have a balance problem, plan on using something for support during your shopping trip. That could be a shopping cart that you lean on, or a store's electric scooter. Or use a rollator, a type of walker with four wheels, handbrakes, and a basket, and a built-in seat. It keeps you stable and gives you a chance to sit down and take a break anywhere, says Barbara Ranucci, a physical therapist at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. She also advises being extra careful when reaching for items. If they're above your shoulders, you might lose your balance and fall backward, Ranucci says. When reaching, stand with 1 foot forward and 1 foot back for stability, or just ask for assistance. Crowded venues. Busy airports, shopping malls, concert halls, or theaters can land you in the middle of crowds, with lots of people who might bump into you, causing a fall. To guard yourself, hold on to a partner as you walk, or use a rollator for stability. The rollator will also act as a red flag to others to use caution around you and give you space, Ranucci says. Are you going for a walk, jog, or hike in a park? Are you taking your grandkids to a playground? Keep an eye out for uneven terrain, which increases your fall risk. Red flag areas include the spots where two types of terrain meet, like a parking lot and a mulchy playground. Make sure you wear the proper footwear, like sneakers with deep, not flat, treads or hiking boots. Public staircases. If you feel unstable on stairs, it's best to avoid them and take on an elevator. If you don't have that option, use extra caution on stairs. They might not be the same depth or width as the stairs you're used to at home. Hold the handrail. Wear glasses if you need them. Go slowly. And if the stairway is dark, keep one hand on the railing and the other on a small portable flashlight or your smartphone with a flashlight app to light the way. Public bathrooms. Bathrooms are notorious for having wet, slippery floors that cause falls. And public bathrooms often have the added hazard of poor lighting and low toilets. Go into the bathroom with caution. Ranucci advises that you have always your phone with you in case you can't get up from the low toilet seat and need to call for assistance. You might also need your phone's flashlight if the bathroom lighting is low. If possible, use the handicap stall, which has grab bars and a high toilet. If you have to cross a wet floor, walk slowly with your feet pointed slightly outward for more stability. Parking lots or garages. While it's good exercise to park far from a store and walk a longer distance, avoid doing this if you have endurance issues or joint pain that increases your fall risk. Park closer to your destination, and don't be reluctant to ask your doctor to approve a handicap placard if you need one. Avoid parking too close to another vehicle, and assuming you can squeeze between your car and the other. Renucci says that makes it difficult to exit a vehicle safely, especially if you use an assistive walking device. And if you have to do any turning or sidestepping to move between vehicles, you might increase the risk of losing your footing and falling. When possible, give yourself plenty of space to get out of your vehicle and move freely. If you have a handicap placard, use the space if it's available. Office buildings. Office buildings are filled with the same types of hazards found at home, like stairs, slippery floors, floor clutter, poor lighting, and loose rugs. Plus, they can have escalators, ladders, scaffolding, industrial equipment, and construction areas, which all increase the risk for falls. Remove what you can from your workspace, like floor clutter and long electric cords, and report fall hazards to management. And if you're visiting an office building, say for an appointment with your doctor, try not to rush as you walk. Move deliberately. Scour the environment as if you're conducting an inspection for potential fall hazards, and avoid them. No matter where you go, balance training will help you do a better job of navigating fall hazards. Leg and core strength are among the most important components for balance. Your vision, inner ear health, and sensitivity in your feet and joints also are essential components of balance. She advises seeking physical therapy if you suspect you have balance issues. If you're generally healthy, make sure your regular exercise routine includes leg and core strengtheners, like sit to stands. This means standing in front of a chair, sitting down, then standing again 5 to 10 times in a row, lunges and leg lifts, and try balance exercises like standing on one leg for 30 seconds at a time, or walking across a room as if you're walking on a tightrope. For more information on balance exercises, check out the Harvard Special Health Report, Better Balance, and that's at www.health.harvard.edu/BB. That's B as in boy. And associated with this article is a small section that's entitled, Consider How the Weather Affects Your Fall Risk. Preparing for the weather before going out is an important part of the plan to maintain balance and avoid a fall. If it's hot and sunny, dehydration can make you feel overheated or woozy, which can cause a fall. Wear a hat, bring a water bottle, stay hydrated, and head for the shade or air-conditioned space when possible. If it's rainy or icy, the risk of slipping increases. Wear the right gear, including non-slip shoes. You need supportive shoes that fit well and have good anti-slip treads. We recommend wearing rubber or spiked shoe covers that you pull on over the sole of your sneaker or boot, says Barbara Renucci, a physical therapist at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. Now, here's an interesting section called Ask the Doctor with Dr. Anthony Komaroff, who's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Health Letter. The first question is, I hear a new study shows that a daily multiple vitamin may help the brain. Any truth to that? And Dr. Komaroff responds, back in September 2023, I answered a similar question. Enough studies on the subject had already been published to lead me to conclude that, at least for a few years, a daily multivitamin pill might help protect against declines in certain aspects of cognition. But I also knew that larger and better studies were nearing completion and were likely to provide a more solid answer. Now they have. The new study you're referring to probably is one organized here at Harvard, involving medical centers around the country. It was the best type of study for determining if a treatment is effective. That is, a randomized controlled trial. Some people were assigned at random to take the multivitamin pill, and others were assigned to take an identical-looking placebo, which means an inactive pill. And neither the study participants nor the research team knew, until the end of the study, who had taken the multivitamins. The new study was published in the January 2024 issue of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition and involved people aged 60 or older. It's better in many respects than past studies have been. It included more people, over 5,000. Followed participants longer, more than 2 years, and more precisely measured cognitive abilities. Both before and 2 years after starting on multivitamins. Two aspects of cognition known to predict the later development of Alzheimer's disease and related kinds of dementia were measured, global cognition and episodic memory. Since there is a slight natural decline in both of these measures with aging, the study was asking if the people taking multivitamins had a slower decline than those taking the placebo. Indeed, both of these cognitive measures declined less over 2 years in those taking the multivitamins than in those taking the placebo. This was seen consistently in all groups of people, regardless of age, sex, race, or ethnic group. Weight, diet, or their level of cognitive ability before the study began, and no adverse effects from taking multivitamins were noted. Based on the results of this study, I think it is likely that a daily multivitamin pill slows age-related cognitive decline, at least for 2 years, in people aged 60 or older. But that leaves many important questions unanswered. Would this benefit persist if people took multivitamins for more than 2 years? Do daily multivitamins also reduce the risk that a person will develop dementia? How do multivitamins produce their positive effect? The pill used in the study contained over 20 vitamins and minerals. Are only some of them responsible for the positive effect? These questions can only be answered by research. We need those answers. And now here's the next article in the Harvard Health Letter of May 2024, and it's called Home Sleep Tests. The popular test is easy to take and can help you uncover potentially dangerous sleep conditions, but it comes with caveats. Do you want to find out if the snoring, gasping, or choking sounds you're making during sleep are actually signs of obstructive sleep apnea? Until recently, you would have had to go to a sleep lab, get hooked up to dozens of sensors, and spend the night. Now, thanks to the miniaturization of sophisticated technology, you can conduct a basic sleep test in your own bed. Home sleep tests are often the preferred approach to detect sleep apnea, not just by doctors, but also by insurance companies. Many are no longer covering in-lab studies, which cost thousands of dollars. A home sleep test costs a few hundred dollars, and it's usually covered, says Dr. Sogal Javahari, a sleep specialist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. However, she cautions that you can't always rely on the results of a home test. What is involved in a home sleep test? You need a prescription for a home sleep test. You can talk to your primary care physician or a sleep specialist about it, or you can order a home sleep test online from any number of companies. You visit a company's website, purchase the test, and talk to a company-affiliated doctor via telemedicine. The doctor can prescribe the test if it's right for you. Dr. Javahari has reservations about arranging a test online. You won't know if it's the best quality sleep test or the best interpretation of the results. A lot of those companies just send a standardized blurb about the results, she says. Either you will pick up your test from your doctor's office or the test will be delivered to you. It involves wearing a few small sensors overnight, typically a nasal cannula, a loop of thin tubing worn under the nose to measure your breathing pattern, a pulse oximeter, a small gadget placed on the finger to measure oxygen levels in your blood, a chest strap, an adjustable belt that measures the effort or movement your body is making to breathe. Each of those sensor plugs into a small data monitor, which is worn on the chest strap. A newer type of home sleep test has even less equipment. The data recorder is worn on the wrist, like a watch. It connects to a pulse oximeter and a small chest sensor. The chest sensor measures breathing effort and snoring sounds. While it's not as detailed or as accurate as an in-lab sleep study, a high-quality home sleep test yields fairly reliable results. You have an 80% chance the test will be right, Dr. Javahari says, but we compare the results with your symptoms to help make sure the results are accurate and to determine the best treatment options. If the test results don't match your symptoms, for example, if you have sleep apnea symptoms and a negative test result, your doctor will have to investigate further. We'll look at the context of the results and the circumstances of the test. It could be that you had nasal congestion on the night of the test. You were breathing through your mouth and the nasal sensor didn't pick that up. If we have strong suspicions that you have sleep apnea, we'll need to schedule an in-lab study. The tests aren't for everyone. People with serious chronic conditions like heart failure or breathing disorder may need additional data from an in-lab study to help determine treatment. For people who don't have serious chronic conditions, a home sleep test can be a game changer. If you have a straightforward case, it's the best way to go, Dr. Javahari says. It's cost-effective, and it's more comfortable than an in-lab study. And since you are doing the test at home, it's more likely to capture your natural sleep habits. Attached to this article is a small section entitled, What is Obstructive Sleep Apnea? Obstructive sleep apnea is a condition marked by 10 to 30 second pauses in breathing during sleep. Those pauses are called apneas and can occur hundreds of times per night. The breathing disruption occurs when the airway in your nose or throat becomes partially or completely blocked by large tonsils, a large tongue, or too much tissue in the airway. Untreated obstructive sleep apnea increases the risk for high blood pressure, heart disease, stroke, daytime sleepiness, and car accidents. Now, here's a useful article in the section entitled The Savvy Patient, Six Things to Do When Heading for the Hospital. You don't always get to prepare for a prolonged hospital stay, but when you know you'll be hospitalized for a few days, such as for an elective procedure, do more than just pack a small bag before you go. Here are six tasks for your to-do list. Your hospital might not have current information in your file, even if you've been there before and your doctor is affiliated with the facility. To be proactive, pack a few documents, print them out in case hospital staffers don't have the time to upload the information in electronic form. One document should be a list of your emergency contacts, of your chronic conditions, and your medications, including supplements, and their doses. This is essential information that doctors use to make decisions about your care. Another document should be a copy of your advance directive, which might include a living will detailing the kind of medical care you'd like if you're unable to make your own decisions, a health care proxy form designating who will make health care decisions if you can't. It's especially helpful when decisions aren't black and white. A POLST, which is a physician order for life-sustaining treatment. This is a form signed by your clinician. This option is for people with serious medical conditions, and it turns your healthcare preferences into a medical order that must be followed. If you need an advance directive, download the forms for free from your state. The AARP offers handy links at www.health.harvard.edu/freepad, FREEPAD. Some forms must be witnessed or notarized, preferably before a hospital stay. Alert your healthcare proxy. Tell your healthcare proxy when and why you're going to the hospital and what should or shouldn't be done if you can't make decisions. Your proxy can only help if he or she knows what you want. Often when we have to call the proxy, the person says, "I don't know. I've never talked to my friend or family member about it." Those situations can be tough for healthcare professionals, because sometimes we're asking them to make decisions about a high-risk treatment, says Dr. Jose Figueroa, a hospitalist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital and a health policy and management researcher at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Pack a little extra. Planned short hospital stays sometimes turn into longer ones, or lead to a stay in a rehabilitation facility. That could leave you without enough clothes, electronic devices, or device chargers. Dr. Figueroa recommends either packing for such an event or packing an extra bag to leave at home and arrange for a friend to deliver if necessary. And then the next section is establish a toothbrushing plan. Ask a friend, family member, or your nurse to help ensure that your teeth are brushed daily. Bacteria in the mouth sometimes get into the lungs and cause pneumonia. Good oral hygiene, including toothbrushing, can lower the risk of pneumonia by decreasing the amount of bacteria on the teeth and in the mouth. We have evidence about this in patients in the intensive care unit, and it's reasonable to think it applies to all patients, says Dr. Michael Klompas, a researcher and infectious disease specialist at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Get a discharge buddy. When it's time to leave the hospital, your nurse will provide you with instructions about your care. But it's a vulnerable time to be getting a lot of information, like details about new medications, old medications, and when you're supposed to see a doctor again. Being confused about what to do next can lead to medication mistakes and hospital readmissions, Dr. Figueroa says. Before your stay, ask a friend to be there at discharge time, in person or on the phone, to jot down details and ask questions. Have the friend ask about medication changes you would be aware of, signs to be worried about, when to call the doctor, and whether you have any new appointments set up or need to make them, Dr. Figueroa advises. You may have a way to get to the hospital, and many people forget about the ride home. We never advise driving yourself home. You might be on medications that affect your ability to concentrate, or you might be confused or weak after a hospital stay, Dr. Figueroa says. If you don't have a friend who can take you home, ask your doctor's office, religious organization, or senior center about ride opportunities. If you can afford it, hire a health aide to drive you. Just make sure there's someone to help you get inside your home and settled. A little advanced planning will go a long way. And then briefly, from the news brief section, what are the most popular video-based medical visits? The use of video calls for healthcare visits skyrocketed during the pandemic, and even though the pandemic seems to have eased, some aspects of video-based telemedicine remain extremely popular, according to evidence published in the February 2024 issue of Annals of Internal Medicine. Researchers analyzed more than 277 million visits within the Veterans Affairs healthcare system from January 2019 to August 2023. Scientists found that video-based visits remain close to the peak pandemic level of about 12%, which is a 2,300% increase from pre-pandemic levels. As of August 2023, video appointments made up 4% of specialist visits, 4% of primary care visits, and 35% of mental health care encounters. Medicare's coverage of telehealth visits is set to expire at the end of 2024, so you might want to take advantage of the service while it's covered. Telehealth visits with occupational therapists, physical therapists, and speech-language pathologists are also covered for now. Congress is currently debating whether to extend Medicare coverage of telemedicine beyond 2024. We will keep you posted. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.